Welcome to the abbreviated Hawks Shortened After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. It's still going to be a fabulous show because I have on a person I have admired. God, Missy Isaacson, Melissa Isaacson, thanks for coming on the phone.
Thanks,
now,
man.
Tell me, how many years have I admired you? How many years? It's got to be like,
oh my gosh,
it's got to be 20 or 30 years. Melissa
so
was.
So many years that you've admired me. No, I'm kidding.
Melissa Isaacson was a, you know, I'm going to call you too, Missy. You know, you were a pioneering sports writer as, you know, if not the first woman hired by the Tribune to cover sports, certainly among the first in this country to cover sports. You consider yourself a pioneer?
That sounds so funny. Linda Kay was a columnist for the Tribune.
Sure.
I really want to give, you know, honor to her. She wrote a column with Skip Myslenski,
yep.
You know, before my time. I covered the Bulls. I believe I was the first woman beat writer for a sports beat, and then the Bears later. And certainly Tony Jannetty across town was covering the Cubs. And
you know, Tony Jannetty,
before
Tony Jannetty covered the Cubs, she was paired with me on a year-long investigative report called Sex for Sale. And you know Tony, and it was it was hard on her. I was taking we'd have to go to these places that flew in the face of her she goes, I'm going to have to go home and tell my mother about this place. I go, no, you don't. No, you don't, Tony. The reason Melissa is on, Melissa left the Tribune some time ago. That was certainly the Tribune's loss. She and I have been talking about a book, the recently published book, State, A Team, A Triumph, A Transformation. This is a book 10 years in the making, and it is among the most compelling, interesting, heart-wrenching in a couple different ways. It's many years in the making, and I just want to start by saying the book was inspired. The way you begin this book, Missy, is so moving and touching. It begins with you in a hospital room with your father, doesn't it?
Yeah, actually, I'm at their home in Lincolnwood that they lived for many, many years, but he was in hospice, so I could see where you think that.
I always think of hospice as a hospital, and it
right.
often isn't. It's usually home, but he is.
It could be, right. And no, he was under hospice care. I mean, the reason I bring up, the only reason I correct you is because it was in Lincolnwood, you know, in their home where they lived, you know, where I lived my entire life. And they had, you know, hospice nurses there. And both my parents were in the final years of Alzheimer's, and my dad in the very final stages. And the hospice nurse was telling me that, you know, I needed to say goodbye, that more than say goodbye, I needed to give him permission to die, which anyone who's ever had, you know, anyone, I mean, it's a horrible thing. And in final stages, many times, you know, people hang on for various reasons. And so we thought that's what my dad was doing, kind of always being the one that, you know, sort of looked over my mom and protected her.
Sure.
And so we sort of, the nurse surmised that he was hanging on for her. And so it was just a really wrenching kind of, you know, day for me with them. And then that night happened to be the 25th reunion of our state championship game at Niles West. You know, we had won the state championship in 79. And so, you know, all of a sudden I'm supposed to just, you know, pack it up and go to the high school and be honored, right? And so, you know, it started there, and it, you know, continues on that night, and that was really the jumping off point for the book, and it was a natural jumping off point, as painful as it was. But that was when I wrote the column for the Tribune 15 years ago.
Yep.
And it was sort of set the stage for writing a book. It really sort of demanded a book after that.
And you also, and I think you can find it at your wonderful, wonderful website, which is melissaisaacson.com. Can you not also find, and this was one of the most jarring, moving pieces I've ever read, when you wrote a Tribune magazine cover story about your parents and their suffering that horrible disease. Is that on your...
It is. Yeah, it is. And it's really interesting. The only reason I, you know, is mostly kind of collecting things about the book and about, you know, that sort of storyline. But then I started collecting other things. And that became was just a natural to put on the website because of all the things I've ever written, and it was really the most difficult thing I've ever written.
I'm sure.
You know, as you know, I mean, we were all taught as journalists not to write about ourselves, that we're not the story, and that was really the first thing I ever wrote that was that personal. So I felt so uneasy doing it, and then afterwards, and to this day, I honestly don't go more than a few months now without still hearing from someone who read it, and so it meant so much to me after it being so difficult that, it was... natural to put it there.
I remember that piece. I remember it well because I read it yesterday again. And I think that piece, I think, Missy Isaacson, seemed to, and tell me if I'm making too much of this, I think it kind of freed you from that burden of, oh, don't write about yourself, you're a journalist. Mm. I think it did because this book is about you. It is about you and this gathering of friends, and it is, you write in the book, and I must tell you, ladies and gentlemen, the writing in here is just stunning. I'm going to read a couple different things, but you write, this story is about one group of girls sitting innocently at the monumental place in our nation's history, but it is not a history lesson, not a treatise on Title IX, as significant and responsible as that piece of legislation was for our being there in the first place. It is about a hunger so insatiable, setback so painful, and a triumph so sweet that they altered the courses of our lives. That is indeed what this book is about. And in that way, Missy, it is a testament also to your reporting skills. You could never, I don't think, let's say you became a doctor or a psychiatrist or an accountant or something. You bring to this the sort of eagerness and hunger that any journalist has for getting the whole story, because some of the places you go in the book are not the triumph of winning the state title is undeniably euphoric. There are some painful moments in this thing too, are there not?
Yeah, I mean, it started as a basketball story because on its own, it was a pretty good basketball story.
Absolutely.
Even if you know that we win at the beginning, it still was, that's how I felt as a sports writer that it should be. And then it became, well, how do I get these other things in there? I know there's more to this. And a friend of mine who's a really gifted writer for Sports Illustrated, Scott Price, his byline is SL.
Oh, yeah, no kidding.
Wonderful author.
Yeah.
And he's a good friend. And every year he would say, every time we'd see him at a tennis tournament or something, he'd say, how's the book going? And I'd be like, yeah, I don't know. It just kept stalling. And I just wasn't sure, how it was going. And finally just said, Missy, it's your story. Just tell it.
Wow.
And it, I don't know why that just triggered something in me that, because I never did think it was my story, and I still don't. I think it's our story.
Well, it's all your stories, but you are the emotional thread throughout this whole thing, and I think your honesty and frankness throughout the whole thing is the thread that holds it, really, Missy, all together. Again, we got to take a little break. The book, the title is State, A Team, A Triumph, A Transformation. I will have Melissa Isaacson explain to all of you people in the dark or taking it for granted what Title IX was and remains and what a unbelievably liberating thing that was for every woman in this country. First, I'll tell you, how were the winner compared to last winter? God, I don't know. Tom Skilling lays it on the line in his long-range forecast. Monday's cover story on WGN TV News at 9. We'll be back with Missy Isaacson in a couple minutes. Welcome back. Here again is another piece of Melissa Isaacson's fine writing from the compelling, exciting, moving book, State, A Team, A Triumph, A Transformation. She writes that this book is also about a hunger so insatiable, setback so painful, and a triumph so sweet that they altered the courses of our lives. Basketball removed us from troubled homes and sad circumstances and transformed us. It instilled confidence and gave us our very identities. We were no longer tomboys or outcasts or even normal girls with unusual interests. Suddenly and forevermore, we were athletes driven by one common goal, united for one solitary purpose. That has got to resonate with any woman, I would think, in high school, especially during the 70s, after Title IX was passed in 72. Talk to me about, Missy, Title IX did what?
Oh, it changed our lives. It changed the entire generation of girls' lives. It's, you know, left its meaning, I think, over the years. It's become sort of a, you know, punching bag, if you will, for all the minor sports and sadly, you know, many minor men's sports have fallen by the wayside and have blamed Title IX.
Sure.
Because, you know, it has to be equal representation on the men's and women's sides. And because football takes up so many roster spots, something has to give. And so Title IX became, you know, that's the reason. They're the bad guys. You know, that's the women's sports. That's what's to blame. And really, kind of misguided, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
What it did so greatly overshadows everything. You know, if you think about before, you know, I look at little kids now and I say, I know you think I'm old, but really, I'm not that old. And, you know, in my lifetime, girls weren't allowed or didn't play team sports. Yeah. When we entered high school as freshmen, there was a boys' gym that we didn't practice in and we couldn't play in. And, you know, girls in high school now kind of think that's crazy, obviously. And it's cool to be an athlete now. That's the greatest joy to see that. It wasn't that cool to be, you know, a tomboy when we were kids. And girls just a little bit older than us, and I'm meeting these women all the time now.
I bet.
I mean, it makes me almost cry to hear these stories, because just a few years older than me, just did not have these opportunities. And it wasn't just opportunities to play sports. It was an access to these life lessons that we learned, that the whole world opened up to us in high school. And boys just sort of had access to, when you're 5 and 6 and playing t-ball, you learn about teamwork and sacrificing for the good of the team and learning about strategy and negotiating and setting goals and all these cool things that set you up for life. And we just didn't learn those things, and we didn't have those ready lessons until we were much older, and girls didn't have them at all.
When you think back on it, it seems like some sexist era of 300 years ago where you, in being able to, just being allowed to participate in sports, you were empowered in a much more effective and meaningful way than being told, oh, your hair looks really nice today, honey. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Or you are a really good cheerleader. I love the way you cheer. It seems so much further removed. One of the, I wanted you to talk a little bit about some of your teammates, but one of the real life characters that just jumped out at me, who begins chapter one of Missy's astonishing book, State, A Team, A Triumph, A Transformation, is Arlene Mulder, who about whom you write. And this is such, if this doesn't grab you, ladies and gentlemen, and drag you to continue reading, I don't know what will. Sometimes, when work ran until dark and fatigue simply won out, she would spend the night in our locker room rather than drive the 17 miles home. We never knew that, of course. Just like we didn't know a lot of things. That is such a compelling paragraph. We cannot tell all the things there are to tell about Irene Mulder, but tell me something, Missy.
Well, I mean, you know, here's this young woman who's 31 years old when she came over. No one wanted the job. No one wanted the girls' basketball job at Niles West. She played girls' basketball in Northern California as a kid. 6 girls, you know, to a side. And knew nothing, though, about coaching. And, you know, was so unselfish. She had 2 little girls at home, and her husband helped out. And she wanted to coach so badly that she went to the boys' coach at the school at the time, Billy Schnurr, who is a wonderful boys' coach, really legendary for what he did as a tactician, and said, teach me the game. And he did, very unselfishly, but secretly, in the corners of the teacher's lounge, he would scribble on napkins and, you know, X's and O's, and literally teach her to teach us. But what she did in the process was learn how to be the leader that she was. She had these unbelievable innate motivational qualities that she imparted onto us. She was doing things that Phil Jackson did years later, that, you know, when I covered the Bulls.
Sure.
You know, gave us books and, you know, just positive mental imagery and all kinds of things. And so in the process, she taught Billy Schnurr about how to relate, you know, interpersonally with athletes that he never did, because in the 70s, it's not how you coach boys. You know, you talk to them by their last names only and made them do push-ups, and that was about it.
Yeah, you throw them around if you have to. Yeah, I remember. Yeah,
and then the things that she, you know, and I said at one point in the book that, you know, while our parents expected great things from us, while they may have expected great things from us, she demanded that, and we didn't have that before. We never had a coach or any, you know, adult absolutely demand that from us. And so that alone, but she became, you know, I don't think I ruined the story for those in your audience.
No.
Who, certainly those from Arlington Heights. You know, she became pregnant. She left school. She left the job on maternity leave, didn't come back, became the assistant rec director at Arlington Heights. And a few years later ran for mayor, and 5 terms later, retired as the 5-term mayor of Arlington Heights.
She's one of the great
politicians in our state.
Not to sound sexist, but I love you girls in the book, too. But she really just is heroic, to my mind.
She's the heroine of the book. There's no question.
She is heroic in this book. Missy, it's a great book. We got to take a break for some commercials and then the news. And then I want to come back after the news and have you. There's another great line in here. I love the way you write about your children. My kids laugh at me when I talk about our glory days. I wanted to get into that because they were glory days when you won the state championship at Niles West. And girls basketball, ladies and gentlemen, it is not to be trifled with. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
Lakefront, that's also your Lake Michigan water temperature, and the wind's pretty light out of the south at 5. I'm Roger Badish on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back. I have only a few more minutes left with Melissa Isaacs, and I'm going to let her go to sleep because she has a job. She has to do something in the morning, unlike many of you. In many ways, if you think of her book, State, A Team, A Triumph, A Transformation, as, wow, okay, it's a book about a women's basketball team, you're being very, very short-sighted. This is a book about so much more than basketball. It'd be like saying, well, you know, Moby Dick is a book about boating, or Grapes of Wrath is a book about farming. This is a book about humanity. The stories deeply reported, and reported by someone who was there. That's one of the hallmarks of this, of what I think is a remarkable book. I'm not the only one. Steve Kerr, who I think of as someone who is, you know, for a coach, pretty literate and actually does read books and has read this book, calls it a beautiful story of basketball and life. And I punctuate the "and life" part of this. Your daughter is not a jock, Missy. Your daughter, Amanda, you write, never did become a jock, but she has always been a great team player who attacks every goal she sets. She also, if genetics plays into it, and you write that she's a very gifted writer. The thing about this, Missy, and I've been reading you for decades, first in the Tribune and then later places, ESPN and other places. Do you know how good this book is? I know that's a horrible question to ask a writer because you have to you go, no, Rick, I think it's terrible.
No.
Do you know? I mean, you obviously work so hard, diligently, and deeply emotionally on this book. Do you know how good this book is?
Oh, gosh. Oh, my gosh. It's so unbelievably nice of you. I mean, all I could hope is that people will read it who, you know, at first you kind of just want something for your family and your teammates to have.
Yeah.
Let's just get the story down so that they'll have it. And then you think, oh, boy, I kind of hope that other people pick it up. And then, you know, they want you to pick a lane. And then you say, well, I don't think it is just a sports book. And I don't think just maybe women will like it. You know, I hope others will like it.
Yep.
So that's kind of where I am. I just really hope people read it. I hope it will resonate with people. And it's so kind of you to say. And I mean, I would love to think it would resonate that same way with with people.
Well, you must have heard
from people.
It's gotten astonishing reviews from not only, you know, writers whom I admire, Andrea Kramer, who's a sport journalist, and other athletes. Billie Jean King, for instance, loves this book. But also, I have heard from people who have seen you speak out and about, and you've been doing some promotional stuff for the book, that this really is, Missy Isaacson, a story that resonates on a number of different levels. You didn't have to be in high school in the 1970s. You don't have to be a woman. It is just simply an exciting and very emotional story. It's light and dark. It's everything that a well-told tale should be. So you can be really, really proud. I remember reading this in sort of galley form and saying, oh my God, this is a great book. Remember that?
Well, you're the one who brought it to the publisher, to Agate Publishing, so and I can't thank you enough for
that.
Don't
be silly.
I mean, I really, honestly, because you know how publishing is,
it's impossible.
It's not easy.
It's not easy.
And my past experience with it was just the typical sports sort of quick turn books where the publisher comes to you and you do it and you hope it comes out. But this was going to publishers and writing a proposal, and you know, there are people who said it's a great story. We don't know if people buy it, or it's a great story, but it's not maybe just for us.
Yeah, most publishers are idiots, frankly. They really are. I mean, they're looking for, you know, the blockbuster this and blockbuster that. This is a book that is going to live for decades. This is a book, you know, I got a 15-year-old daughter now, and it's going to, next time I see her, she's going to get not much of an athlete, but she loves to draw. But it doesn't matter. It is on one level a book about sports, but on the most profound and important level, it's a book about life and what it's like what it's like to be a teenager. Those are not easy years. And you reminded, in many ways, you reminded good old, you know, Rick Kogan football player in high school. Missy, it's not my place to be proud of you, but this is a hell of a book.
Thank you, Rick. I can't thank you enough.
Don't be silly.
You know how I feel about you. If you don't, I just
go to sleep.
Really look up to you so much. Well, thank you.
Listen to her. She's rambling. She's so tired. She has to get up and teach tomorrow.
You're the best.
The book is called Thank You, Sweetie. I can't wait to read the next one, and I hope there is a next one.
I do, too.
The book is State, A Team, A Triumph, A Transformation. Melissa Isaacson has a wonderful website, melissaisaacson.com, on which you can read a number of her previous stories, including the story about her parents both being afflicted with Alzheimer's, like at the same time. It is a story that she wrote for the Tribune magazine that touched and continues to touch anybody who has been touched by that disaster. Missy, good night.
Thank you, Rick.
My
good
pleasure,
night.
Sweetie.
Well, I guess you can't go to night.
No, I can't.
But good night anyway.
I never sleep.
Take care, honey.
Thank you. And thank you for writing the book. Again, ladies and gentlemen, State, A Team, A Triumph, and A Transformation. Very much changing gears. We will be talking to the artist, raconteur, gallery owner, actor, radio host, everything. A man about town, too. Tony Fitzpatrick after a commercial break. Welcome back. When Tony Fitzpatrick calls or emails or somehow puts up smoke signals to get in touch with me, I always respond because he always has something interesting to say or someone interesting to introduce me to. He last called last week to tell me that on November 6th, a friend of his named Xander Berkeley is going to be opening a show at the gallery that Tony runs mostly with his son Max, the Dime Gallery, 1513 Northwestern Avenue. And I said, sure, yeah, I'll put him on the radio. Does he live here? No, he lives somewhere else. So Tony is on now. Tony, I got to tell you something. When I looked up and I Googled and said images and saw the face of Xander Berkeley, it is a face that I have seen hundreds of times, is it not?
Oh, absolutely.
It's like, I thought, oh my God, did I go to high school with this guy? He has been in It's more than dozens of movies, dozens of TV shows.
He's got 300 film credits since about 1981, when he was on, I think, the last MASH.
Wow, the last episode of MASH, the most watched TV show in history.
I've been seeing him forever. And
how did you meet him?
You know what? I met him through my castmate in Patriot, Kurtwood Smith.
Okay.
And we met electronically. I started seeing these drawings and paintings by Xander Berkeley, and I knew him as an actor, and I thought, it can't be the same guy.
Exactly.
I mean, that's a really rare name. You know, how many guys name,
X-A-N-D-E-R?
Not many.
I found, too, I mean, I just see his face and realize that I didn't go to high school with him, but I'd seen him in a million different movies. His artwork, I find stunning. What did you think?
Well, what's amazing is that I think the reason he wound up following the career path as an actor is that's what began to, you know, happen for him first.
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
That was the thing that offered the most viable career path. But he never stopped, you know, and as years went by, the last few years, people were like, you got to see Xander Berkeley's work. He's also a painter. And for the last couple of years, I've been quietly reaching out to actors that I know who also make visual art. You'd be surprised how many of there are.
Well, because
in Chicago, you know, Frank Guinan.
Sure.
Christian Salty. You know, eventually I'm going to have a big group show these people. You know, over at Red Orchid, Dato.
Right, of course, of course.
It's not an unusual kind of
well, one of the things, one thing I find very interesting about him and the way he came to it is you sort of came to acting. You're the visual artist who was drawn to acting, correct? I mean, what do you mean, correct?
Yeah,
I'm your official biographer.
When I was a young man, I wanted to be a playwright.
Right.
And, you know, as a result of that, wound up in a play and won a Jeff Award, you know, so.
Yeah. What do you think it is, Tony? It's hard to speculate, but I mean.
People will sometimes say to me, you know, are you an artist who acts or are you a
actor who
makes visual art? And I always thought to myself, it's all part of the same thing. It's all part of, you know, a body of work.
But it's also all part of this, a sort of creative urge. And my thought is that as an actor, unless you've written the play and then perform it, a la this Ronnie Marmo's one-man show about Lenny Bruce that just opened here, which you should see.
By the way, I can't wait to see that.
It's pretty amazing. I saw it last week. He's a cool guy, too. Let me know. I'll go with you if you want. But there's something about acting is you're reading someone else's lines and you're doing, you know, you're at the beck and call of directors and lighting people. Being a visual artist allows you to spread your creative wings much more than being on a stage, except when you were in your own show.
Yeah, I mean, it's a different discipline. I mean, when I show up to set, I mean, I don't have any qualms about why I'm there. I'm there to serve the story.
Exactly.
And, you know, the director is boss, and the narrative is boss. That's what you were there to serve. And, you know, a lot of, you know, my son Max is first a director and became an actor. And,
right.
A lot of people go, well, what I want to really do is direct. It's like, not me. That's just too much work. You know, it's like, I know what it's like to have to be responsible for every single vestige of a work of art. I mean, I do that every day, you know. But I was fascinating that that Sandra, you know, not only is an incredibly prolific actor, but he's also an incredibly prolific artist. I mean, there are pages after pages of.
But he did.
Stuff. I mean, the biggest problem we had was trying to figure out which body of work to.
Well,
because
he's also, he's a painter, he's a sculptor, he's everything. But also, what occurs to me is much of his artwork was done because he didn't need to go out and sell his work. He sort of sold.
He sold to friends.
There was none of that gallery pressure.
Circumstance for a visual artist. It's like, it doesn't matter whether he sells it or
not.
Right. I also think that, for the longest time, I think he resisted pursuing exhibitions.
I think he did, too.
First of all, he's busy, you know.
Yeah.
And people, if they're not putting it together who he is yet, if you watch the first couple seasons of 24, he played Kiefer Sutherland's boss.
And The Walking Dead, and he's...
The Walking Dead, yeah, I would like just one of those residual checks.
Was it hard?
You
were introduced by a friend, Tony Fitzpatrick. Was it hard for you? Was it hard for you to convince him to allow the Dime Gallery to?
No, because luckily our mutual friend Kurtwood Smith, who was on Patreon with me, and people. We'll know that name because he played the father in that 70s show.
Okay.
He played Red Foreman.
Oh, right.
And Kurtwood goes way back with Xander and via Patriot. I mean, Kurtwood and I became very good friends. So I said, I'd really love to reach out to this guy and get a show of his work because I was looking for any... list of exhibitions that he'd already had. I mean, there weren't a lot of them.
There aren't at all.
Yeah, so I thought, boy, it would be really cool to have the first Chicago exhibition of Xander Berkeley.
Was he flattered when you asked?
Yeah. He's a great guy. He now lives in Maine.
Where all actors in demand live. He can afford to live there. You know, someone calls him and says, come to the movie shoot. How many pieces?
He also inherited this. His mom passed away recently at the age of 102. And he inherited this huge barn
Perfect for the artist's life.
Building an artist retreat.
The artist's life. Is he going to be at the opening?
Yeah, he'll be there. He's coming out. He's coming out next Sunday.
Okay,
we will sort through the work and. The opening is the night of November 6th, a Wednesday night,
6 o'clock.
And usually we have those on Friday.
Right.
But Xander's got.
He's got to go make a movie or something, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this guy's incredibly in demand.
Tony, I'm going to call you tomorrow. This guy is worth a story too. Plus, I haven't written.
Yeah, You know what? I'm also thinking. Let's go get lunch. I mean, he's a phenomenal storyteller. He's like funny. He's like one of the most interesting people I've ever met, and I have only spoken with him on the phone and corresponded with him email. I mean, I'll meet him in person for the first time next Sunday.
You can go. You'll find. Go to thedimechicago.com, and you'll see a couple of his works, and then you'll figure out how to spell his name, and you can go explore him further on the internet, and you too will look at his face and go, wait, I went to high school with that guy.
Familiar.
Wait a minute. I was in jail with that guy.
He's been in all kinds of roles, too.
I know.
He's had great big parts. He's had small parts. I think his most indelible performances was in the movie Heat, where he's the guy who is having an affair with Al Pacino's wife.
Oh, my God, that's right.
Walks in, and it's, Denver is smoking gun, and he utters that immortal, kind of not highlight of Al Pacino's acting career, electrocution, he had a great ass, you know?
Yeah, great ass, the way he screams like that.
Yeah, ever since Sons of a Woman, he's allowed this goofiness to kind of seep in. Although I am looking forward to seeing The Irishman.
Oh, who isn't? Who isn't? Yeah. I can't wait. Tony,
it's like 3.5 hours long, something like that.
And you know what? The other thing, it costs $120 million to make, too. That's
interesting. That's why Netflix made it.
Yes, and it's the only movie I can think of now that doesn't star either Tony Fitzpatrick or Xander Berkeley. It stars as De Niro and Pacino and Joe Pesci. Tony, I can't wait to see you. This is going to be a really sensational show because
let's get lunch with Xander.
Absolutely,
that guy is really a fascinating human being.
Well, so are you, pal. So are you. Love to family.
Hey, thanks.
To the family.
Checking in, man.
Hey, the Dime Gallery is at 1513 Northwestern Avenue.
November 6th from 7 to 10.
And Tony occasionally has free beer there, though he doesn't drink it. He hasn't had a drink in many, many years.
I just hand it out.
He hands it out. He's like a do-it-yourself bartender. Tony, love to the family, honey. Love to the family.
Take care, bro.
All right, you too. That is the one and only Tony Fitzpatrick. Ro Coleman, thanks for producing chores. This was a tough one, man. Dan Long, the world's greatest engineer. What do you have to do? Do you have to do anything? No, this is easy. We could do an hour show for the rest of our lives every night. Thank you all for listening. Carl Amari is coming up after some commercials and the news with Vic Vaughn.